TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Dismantle the Doomsday Machine. Abolish nuclear weapons. Daniel Ellsberg at the gates of Lawrence Livermore Lab. There are two locations where all U.S. nuclear weapons are designed. Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California is one of them. Since 1983, Tri-Valley Cares has monitored nuclear weapons and environmental cleanup throughout the U.S., with a special focus on Livermore Lab. Every year on August 6, Tri-Valley Cares and supporters gather at the gates of Livermore Lab to remember the victims of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This year, 2023, the silent vigil was also dedicated to Daniel Ellsberg. He had been at the gates of Livermore Lab many times in the past and gotten arrested for blocking the entrance. He died in June of this year at age 93. Ellsberg had released the Pentagon Papers to hasten an end to the war in Vietnam. He was an analyst at the RAND Corporation and a consultant on nuclear warfare to the U.S. Defense Department. Ever since his experience with nuclear war planning, Ellsberg demanded dismantlement of what he termed the Doomsday Machine. Enchanted Films showed a movie with Daniel Ellsberg at the August 2023 vigil at Livermore Lab. They assembled many profound and fact-filled speeches Ellsberg had given at the gates of Livermore Lab, including two recent ones on Zoom when COVID made being there in person too risky. Here's Daniel Ellsberg in 2020 and 2021.
Hi, I'm Dan Ellsberg. I was 14 when the bomb exploded over Hiroshima. I'm 89 now. 75 years have gone by. And it's time, I think, beyond time, to reflect on something that Mahatma Gandhi posed 75 years ago, a few weeks after Hiroshima. He described the event as having set him into silence, almost paralysis for some time, thinking it was the most diabolical use of science there had ever been, and that it was a sign that the world must adopt nonviolence or would face certain suicide. So far, it has not meant suicide for humanity. But he raised the question in this form, what this has done to the soul of a destroying nation is yet too early to see. Well, 75 years have gone by, and that question has hardly been addressed, and I would say it's not too early to look for an answer to that right now. First of all, what's missing in most discussions of this decision and making and what's followed it is the fact that the use of the bomb against civilians, killing 100,000 or so, women and children mainly, with the men mostly being away at war at that time in Hiroshima, was for the American people a shocking revelation that we seem to have changed the millennia-old proscription against deliberate, indiscriminate targeting of non-combatants, and that we had destroyed a city of non-combatants in a flash. That was a startling revelation to many people, but not to the people inside the government, who were aware that they had crossed that barrier years earlier. First, in imitation of Hitler and the Blitz over London, and even earlier, the Japanese and the bombing of Guernica in Spain. The British had adopted nighttime firebombing of cities in Germany because it was too costly for them to face anti-aircraft and fighter pilots in the daytime. Our bombers' pilots at first described that as baby killing and eschewed it in favor, supposedly, of high-altitude bombing of military targets and bases, but found that that was ineffective, and we turned to the British or Nazi method of firebombing by 1944, almost entirely in Japan. specifically on the night of March 9th, 10th, 1945, General Curtis LeMay sent some 300 bombers over Tokyo and killed between 80 and 120,000 civilians, burned to death in one night. The largest act of terrorism, the deliberate killing of noncombatants for a political purpose in history, and more than was killed in either Hiroshima or Nagasaki or almost altogether. And in fact, our Air Force under LeMay had been doing that as much as they could to other cities, over 64, perhaps 100 cities in Japan, night after night, almost every other day, killing between several hundred thousand and 900,000 Japanese civilians before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So Hiroshima did not represent a change in, let's say, the souls of the people sending those bombers over. When we say soul, I think we're talking about essence, morality, spirit of a person or a nation. And the Americans were confronted now with the fact that they, I don't think they did realize they had been lied to about our seeking exclusively military targets up till that time. But the issue was now raised. Was this justified? And in answer to that, former Secretary of War Stimson, in an article drafted by McGeorge Bundy, later assistant to John F. Kennedy, and largely set in its framework by James Conant, the president of Harvard, who had been in charge of the atomic bomb program, gave an explanation which was essentially false. Peter Kuznick and many other historians have made it clear now that the explanation given to the American public was false, that the bomb had been actually a savior of lives, that there was no other way to achieve a surrender on our terms, and we were ready to allow the emperor to remain, which was the basic term asked for by the Japanese emperor and his subordinates, had been available actually for some months before that, and that the entry of the Soviet Union, which was scheduled for August 14th at least, and took place on August 8th after the first atom bomb, was certain to cause the Japanese to turn to us with that proposal immediately, and we would accept it, so that the war could have been ended, possibly, and actually from the Japanese point of view, very probably, before August of 1944, had they chosen to do that. But there was a desire to use the bombs before the Soviet entry, or with it, and to end the war with that rather than earlier, so that the demonstration of our willingness to use this bomb ruthlessly and indiscriminately would be a warning to the Soviets, perhaps roll them back in East Europe, which they were then occupying. It had no chance of doing that, and it failed to do that, nor did we achieve the monopoly of the bomb that, again, Truman and Groves, in charge of the project, delusionally believed was available to us, a delusion which kept them from any real interest in renouncing use of the bomb or seeking genuine international control that would prevent us from using it. So since that time, we have never rejected first use of that bomb on the president's judgment, not only to deter Soviet or other attack, which wasn't even possible before 1949, but to establish, in effect, a protectorate over the European nations and others, Japan and others, which would give a strong alliance and economic relationships that would be profitable, influential in a variety of ways. The Russians imitated that buildup in the mid-60s. Now, a number of scientists at the time who knew about the bomb from the beginning advised in May and June of 1945, before the test of the bomb in July, that to test it, let alone to use it without warning against an enemy that the Soviets knew was approaching surrender, which wanted surrender anyway, would assure that there was no possibility of international control or of preventing the Russians, inducing the Russians in any way to refrain from imitating our testing. which they did with the help of spies, actually, at the beginning. They actually first tested a direct blueprint of our bomb, which they'd gotten from Klaus Fuchs. But on their own, they proceeded, as our scientists had predicted, within a few years, to match our technical achievement. And within 10 years, had done what the scientists also predicted, produce an H-bomb, a thermonuclear bomb, 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki. In fact, a fusion bomb, an H-bomb, which required a Nagasaki bomb as its trigger. And at the height of the arms race which ensued, as predicted by the scientists, the world saw 70,000 nuclear weapons in existence in the US and Russia, most of them thermonuclear weapons. That means that there have been, since for more than half a century, two doomsday machines, which I describe them as such, because each of them, if carrying out its plans against the other adversary, even against military targets in and around cities, would cause firestorms, like the one we produced in Tokyo, that would loft smoke into the stratosphere where it would not rain out, go around the world, reduce sunlight by 70%, and kill most vegetation and harvests, all harvests, essentially for as much as a decade, dooming almost all of humanity in the entire globe to starvation, near extinction. And moreover, both of these doomsday machines are on hair trigger alert, in the sense that to protect their international continental ballistics, which are each vulnerable to attack by the other, from being attacked on the ground, in the event of either warning, of radar warning, which has often been false, or of strategic warning in the form of some armed conflict between the US and Russia, which has not yet ever occurred, but which would be expected to lead before long to escalate both to nuclear war and to all-out nuclear war. And again, in those circumstances, each side is prepared to launch its forces against another in another delusional belief that going first surely is better than going second, no matter how bad it is. That is false since the discovery of nuclear winter 35 years ago. It won't make any difference. But it is profitable on both sides to imagine that it will make a difference because that leads to the production of weapons that provide jobs, votes, and profits on both sides, and to warn the other that the other must be very careful not to provoke such an attack. The thing we learned from Hiroshima was that since the attack had saved American lives, supposedly, and had been judged against alternatives and reflectively and analytically, and with great success, that we could trust the judgment of our political leaders to decide when and how to use them. And that basic trust, which was never justified, was because there were many reasons for doing this at the time, none of them adding up to an adequate justification for taking on the production, eventually, of these doomsday machines. This is not a species to be trusted with nuclear weapons. There has never been a leader of Russia or a leader of the US or the other nuclear countries whose judgment should be trusted to preserve prudently and safely this standoff between doomsday machines that may go off at any crisis in particular, any false alarm, any kind of armed conflict of the kind that still is contemplated and against which both sides have warned and promised and ready themselves to initiate nuclear war. In short, what has happened to the soul of the destroying countries and to the others that have now imitated it does portend not the certain doom of humanity in any particular time, but a constant risk of most humans on Earth and many other species disappearing within a matter of months or years at the judgment of leaders such as Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin or the others. This has been accepted wrongly for very long. That has defined, in a way, our existing spirit and morale and morality, that must change if we care as a species for prolonging this experiment of life on Earth, and human life on Earth. We must reverse this process, and by protest and legal means and constitutional means, every other, to take this out of the hands of the leaders that have put us in this position at last, and act for our species' survival. Thank you.
Here's Daniel Ellsberg in 2021.
You should wear a coat and tie when getting arrested. For the last 2 years, you and I have typically gotten arrested either on Hiroshima Day or Nagasaki Day. What is the point of that? In part, it's because I say I would like people to see that possessing a coat and tie does not excuse you from the obligations of citizenship. And in situations like today, or in the context we are protesting and condemning, those obligations include sending as strong a message as we can that business as usual is not appropriate, that we're in an emergency, and that that emergency has a moral dimension, and that we are willing to spend not just a few hours or a day, but for most of us, a significant part of our lives, trying to warn our fellow citizens that there is an obligation to stop business as usual at Livermore and Los Alamos, in the Pentagon in general, in terms of nuclear weapons, just as Greta Thunberg, calling for a general strike on Fridays, was conveying the message that we are in an emergency with respect to climate that calls for people acting out of the ordinary and calling on others to do the same. Can that possibly work? I know it can, because I felt that pressure on my own life. It changed my life. If it were not for young Americans who were willing to go to prison to make the strongest message they could that this war, Vietnam War, should not be participated in, that it was wrong, that message got through to me and changed my life and raised the question in my mind, what could I do to help shorten this war back 50 years ago? Now that I'm ready to go to prison, like these others, following their example. But the much more general message that needed to be conveyed was, if people are willing to risk the good reputation of their team, of their boss, if they're willing to risk their careers, their clearances, their access, could they not do more to warn their fellow citizens and move them to action than when they don't take that risk? I needed that example, certainly, of moral courage, the willingness to risk ostracism, like my other fellows in government, because we'd simply never asked ourselves the question whether it might be our duty to resist the president and his policies. After all, we had virtually all signed on to be president's men. In those days, it was almost entirely male. Now there's a few women involved. To be loyal, to be faithful, reliable, obedient in doing whatever he wanted, including, and again, the president up till now has only been male, but there would be the same with a female president who was wrongly keeping secrets about a policy that was heading us toward disaster. After all, we're following, you and I who do this, the teaching of Henry David Thoreau, whose essay in 1849, 172 years ago, was first entitled Resistance to Civil Government, and then later published on the title The Duty of Civil Disobedience, or sometimes just called An Essay on Civil Disobedience. The idea that it might be our obligation to break a promise of paying taxes or keeping secrets or passively going along with what was then happening, actually, a war against Mexico, which he rightly described as an imperial war, an aggressive war, absolutely a war of aggrandizement on the order of European monarchies. That last description is actually a little closer to, of all people, President Ulysses S. Grant, who in his memoirs described the Mexican War in which he'd participated in exactly those terms, and said that he regretted intensely that he had lacked, quote, the moral courage to refuse his orders to participating in that war, to provoking a war with Mexico and carrying it through when he was an officer in the army. And he said that it was crucial, that one, to bringing on the civil war later. The other evil that Thoreau was protesting by going to jail against his wishes, he was bailed out very quickly by a relative. He preferred to stay in and go to trial if that had been possible. But the other was slavery. And as Lincoln put it, if slavery is not wrong, then nothing is wrong. We are saying that is true of the doomsday machines which exist in the United States and smaller ones in seven other states, 30 nations accepting the protection, supposedly, of threats of initiating nuclear war to defend them. In other words, prolonging our protectorate at the cost of making that protectorate credible by building systems that can destroy most human life on Earth as a result of nuclear winter. In the early 80s, President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev agreed and stated, nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. And that has been reiterated just recently in this presidential term by Putin and Biden, both, each of which is still involved, as were Reagan and Gorbachev when they said that, in building up our first strike, our first use capabilities for disarming the opponent in various cases. In other words, saying that the nuclear war could not be won did not slow up the arms race at all or reduce the risks of nuclear war, which I would say persist as before, not less than before, the last 50 years of the nuclear arms race. The number of weapons on the U.S. and Russian side have been reduced by over 80%, and that has had no effect on the risk of a war based on a false alarm, on which we launched on warning, are the ICBMs on either side. It hasn't resulted in getting rid of those ICBMs, which are not just anachronistic, but extremely dangerous as hair triggers to the doomsday machine. How is it then that that assertion is not reflected at all in our policies? Well, they didn't say and didn't believe a nuclear war must not be threatened as a basis for alliances or for our protectorate over others, in the U.S. case in particular. Actually, the Chinese have asserted the ability in various contexts of initiating nuclear war in relation to Taiwan, which they regard not as an other nation, but as a province of their own nation. And our commitment, in the words of Biden and Trump and others, to defend Taiwan, the independence of Taiwan against any military attack from China, puts us on a collision course with China that could, in fact, lead to partial or total nuclear winter. I did not risk life in prison, which I was charged with, a possible 115 years, nor did anyone of the 5,000 who actually did go to prison in this country do that because we thought the war was not winnable. And if we thought it was winnable, they wouldn't have done that. That's not the case for any one of them. They and I did it because we understood that the war was wrong. It was as wrong as slavery was wrong. If these are not wrongs, if the existence of a doomsday machine is not wrong, as Lincoln put it, then nothing is wrong. And it is wrong. So this willingness then to defy the popularly supported movement toward preparation for nuclear war, risk of it in ways that could be terminated and reduced, threats of it, which persist on both sides actually now, more than before, but have always existed for the U.S., that this was wrong, never justified. How about then the threats to do it? That has maintained a real threat, a real risk, a danger from year to year of our destroying most life on Earth. We as a species are on the Titanic, or as Nikita Khrushchev called it during the Cuban Missile Crisis, our arc. And what is at stake is not just mutual destruction, let's say, of the US and Russia, horrific as that would be, but the annihilation of most of the species, neutrals, people in the Southern Hemisphere who had nothing to do with this, whether it's near extinction or less than that, a totally wicked gamble. What is called for now is what was called for on the Titanic that night, mutiny by the second in command, who knew what they were doing, knew the risks they were taking, but didn't jeopardize his job, or for that matter, the captain, who wasn't actually ordered to move ahead, but knew that's what his bosses wanted, and that his own career depended on that. So he took a gamble which our presidents and the Russians, and to a somewhat lesser degree, all of the other nuclear states are making hostages of the lives of most people on Earth. That is wrong, and it should be mutinied, and we can continue to do what you and I have been doing for years here, and more than that, as I say, not just going to jail on the anniversary of those two acts of mass murder, of second-degree murder, which could be called depraved indifference murder, which is a legal category, meaning not an intention deliberately to kill any one person, but taking risks of doing that to many people, which are unconscionable, which indicate an absolute lack of concern for others, quote, others, not us, them, enemies, and even neutrals. People I'm speaking to, I know very well from having been in jail on various occasions with them, for having risked arrest, for doing what we can to turn this ship around, know well that nothing less than that is called for. So thank you for what you've done in the past and what you will do in the future. It gives us a chance.
That was Daniel Ellsberg's 2021 message for the vigil on Hiroshima Day at the gates of Livermore Lab in California, where nuclear weapons are being designed. Ellsberg, best known for the release of the Pentagon Papers, also was a consultant to the U.S. Defense Department. His acclaimed autobiography is titled Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Thanks to Tri-Valley Cares and Enchanted Films for recording and preserving the voice of their friend and supporter, Daniel Ellsberg, and sharing with me on TUC. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.